This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 19th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the Hong Kong news agenda with our bureau chief, Aisha Spears. What have you got for us today, Aisha?
We're going to talk about Hong Kong's identity issue, the July 1st protests, and the city's light pollution problems.
Also on the show, Assange the Ecuadorian celebrates his first birthday, but could the embassy ever kick the WikiLeaks founder out?
Then it's to the box office and the battle of good versus evil.
You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier.
Yes, Andrew and I will be donning our latex suits, underpants on top, of course, to ask, what is it about superheroes?
Plus, we'll be in Berlin to hear what President Obama's up to, and we'll be hearing from the entrepreneurs trying to introduce hungry business students to social enterprise.
So student teams of about 4 to 5 students develop viable social enterprises that they then pitch in either Boston, San Francisco, London, Dubai, Shanghai, or Sao Paulo.
All of that, plus we'll play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. How will we fit it all into an hour, I wonder? We're going to do it, aren't we, Andrew?
I think just about.
Excellent.
We're superheroes.
We are. That, I have to say, that is sort of the bit I'm looking forward to most in today's show.
I was worried about your pants being on the outside of your trousers, but now I understand.
I mean, it was weird every other day, but today it actually makes sense for once, which is nice. Barney Burnham is here first. He's got the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United Nations says 7.6 million people became refugees last year, and the total number of over 45 million refugees worldwide is now the highest since 1994. A new report from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says Syria is a major factor in the increase in refugee numbers, and 55% of all refugees come from just 5 countries: Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and Sudan. 81% of all the world's refugees are now hosted by developing countries. UNHCR Chief Antonio Guterres says the figures are alarming and show that there's a new displaced person every 4.1 seconds. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has again called on all parties to come together to find a political solution to the fighting in Syria.
More than 93,000 people have already been killed during the last 2 years, and more than 1.6 million people have fled their countries as refugees now. A quarter of the population, of total population of Syria, have been affected and they need urgent humanitarian assistance. We cannot go on like this way. This is unacceptable.
4 American soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan. Officials say they were killed by indirect fire from insurgents at the Bagram Air Base near Kabul. The attack came just hours after the US announced that it was to begin direct talks with the Taliban. One of the conditions of the talks, due to begin in Doha on Thursday, was that the Taliban would renounce violence. Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff says she's proud of the tens of thousands of people who've taken part in protests across the country. Demonstrators have taken to the streets demanding improvements to schooling and public transport. There's also been anger at the amount of money being spent on new sports stadia and on next year's Football World Cup. The newly appointed governor of Luxor, who was a member of the militant group blamed for slaughtering 58 tourists in Egypt's Valley of the Queens in 1997, has promised to keep visitors safe. Adil Mohamed Al-Kayat's appointment by President Morsi has provoked an angry response. Critics say it's the last nail in the coffin of tourism. Egypt's tourism minister has resigned in protest, but Prime Minister Hisham Kandil is refusing to accept his resignation. Former tourism minister and opposition member Munir Fakhri Abdelnou is appalled by Al-Kayat's appointment.
I think it's an insult. It's an insult to the tourism industry. It's an insult to the tourists. It's an insult to the Egyptians. The Egyptians are proud of their history, are proud of their culture. And those people, unfortunately, have absolutely no recognition for the Egyptian history and the Egyptian culture.
The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has marked the first anniversary of his taking sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy in London by giving an interview in which he says he won't leave even if Sweden stops pursuing sexual assault claims against him. He's told Reuters that he fears arrest on the order of the United States even if the Swedish investigation is called off, and his lawyers have advised him not to leave the embassy. He also says he regards Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor who made revelations about US surveillance programs, as a hero. A New York-based artist has opened the largest ever exhibition of Lego art. The exhibition, called The Art of the Brick, features more than 100 sculptures made of Lego bricks. Some are of life-sized humans, some are pop art figures, and there's a sculpture of a dinosaur made from over 80,000 Lego bricks. There are also Lego versions of famous paintings by Munch and Vermeer. Nathan Sawyer created the exhibition inside Discovery Times Square in the heart of New York City.
I've worked with many different types of art medium over the year, but I just thought about this toy from my childhood and thought, could I create large-scale sculptures using just Lego bricks? And the reaction has been fantastic. It makes the art accessible so that kids and families see the art. They can relate to it because we've all played with Lego bricks at some point in our lives.
So true. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It's currently 8:06 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And at this point in Midori House, we must set the agenda. We must set today's agenda. And our Hong Kong bureau chief joins us on the line now to do exactly that. Aisha Spears, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm good. The agenda here is very hot and sticky.
I see.
The weather agenda in Hong Kong.
Okay, so that's top. Let's move down to the second item, which apparently is about how Hong Kongers are defining themselves.
Indeed. So they're probably defining themselves as sweaty, but also not as Chinese, as is what the South China Morning Post is reporting today. There's a poll that's held twice a year by the University of Hong Kong. And this poll that was the last time it was held was in December. This most recent one that was held the other day has seen a 14-year low in Hong Kongers identifying themselves as Chinese. Obviously, this is a huge melting pot of a city. But as tensions rise with Beijing from here, people feel less and less inclined to call themselves Chinese.
And in what ways does that kind of reveal itself, do you think? When you speak to people who live there, are they kind of clear to kind of trying to put some clear water between them and mainland China? What is it about what's happening in mainland China that they don't want to associate themselves with?
I think it's a greater influence. From what I've heard, it's a greater influence of mainland China here in Hong Kong. So not only from the economy, obviously Hong Kong now is looking a lot more towards China for them to keep for the financial stability the city is used to, but also there are more mainland Chinese buying property, buying shops. There's greater influence across education. And I definitely haven't mastered it yet, but Hong Kong people here really, they know if someone's from mainland China. They can tell, it seems, immediately by the way people will, or not. Obviously there's a difference between Mandarin Cantonese, but people will act. Hotels have to cater to mainland Chinese customers in a totally different way. There is an other factor in it, and it doesn't seem that many Hong Kong people want to identify themselves as simply Chinese. They're either Hong Kong Chinese, they're Chinese from Hong Kong, or they are Hong Kongers. The majority of people wanted to call themselves Hong Kongers.
Well, I suppose it is about names and words, isn't it, this sort of issue, exactly what you want to be called and the associations with that. One of the categories I note in this as well was global citizens. I would have imagined that it would be a sort of place where plenty of people would define themselves as none of these things, but as a citizen of the globe.
Indeed. Well, when I saw that, I want to look a little bit more into the global citizen identification, because I think a lot of people who are listening to Monocle 24 could identify with that. There are a lot of people here who have multiple homes, who aren't originally from Hong Kong, who have come here, who were born in Hong Kong, who emigrated and came back. A lot of people who don't simply see being a Hong Konger, being Chinese, whatever it is, whatever identity you pick, as something which is clear. So hopefully, as such a global city, we'll see less definition between needing to say you're from Hong Kong or from China. There are a lot of global citizens here, yes.
I think you're one of them, aren't you, Aisha? I think with all the boxes you're currently ticking, our New York bureau chief moved to Hong Kong, raised in England. an interesting parentage as well. So, well, I'll leave that to you, to which box you're going to tick in the future. But kind of linked to this story, in a way, is the anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong to China, which is approaching July the 1st. Huge protests planned, but there is some rumours that they're trying to do things to scupper it with a little bit of music along the way.
Indeed. So there's been a tension that people at the government, the Beijing, have tried to scupper these protests in the past. July 1st is a big holiday here because it does mark the handover. And it's also a big pro-democracy protest. There's a huge march that goes on. Last year was the largest ever protest, and activists claimed that about 400,000 people attended that. So a few weeks ago, we saw the vigil in Victoria Park, the very rainy vigil for Tiananmen Square massacre, and now we're seeing the protest against the handover. But this year, the Performance Industry Association has organised something called the Hong Kong Dome Festival, which is a concert full of all sorts of K-pop acts that I've never heard of, but apparently I've been told are really big deals. And the tickets have been made very, very cheap. They're 99 Hong Kong dollars. And it's being argued by a lot of these protesters that this is a pro-Beijing association who's offering these very discounted tickets in order for young people not to take to the streets.
So presumably no, all of these people aren't going to then buy tickets. They're gonna boycott the attempted boycott, I would imagine. I mean, what was opposition growing? Has the sort of trend for protest this time of year been on the up recently?
Well, this year is a particularly big deal because there's so much dislike of CY Leung, who is the chief executive here. He was inaugurated into that position a year ago on July 1st, and there's speculation that he's a bit of a Beijing puppet. So that's why a lot of people think that this year will be a particularly strong demonstration. The concert is already sold out, and I doubt there's a huge Venn diagram between teenagers who want to see people called Shiny and Fix and Rubber Band. Apparently they're playing a big K-pop act. So I don't know if there's a big Venn diagram between those people and those who will be taking to the streets against pro-democracy. But the association who've planned this concert have said that they're mounting this event to highlight that Hong Kong doesn't have a good music venue, and that's the only reason they're doing it on July 1st.
Now, one of the things that strikes anybody who visits Hong Kong, and when they pull back the curtains in their hotel room and look out over the water, is the extraordinary light display that goes on at night in Hong Kong. It's not just the kind of electronic billboards we see here in Europe, but vast kind of buildings turned into kind of light displays. But finally, Hong Kong's wondering if this has gone a bit too far, it seems.
Indeed. So a group set up in 2011 who presented a paper to the Legislative Council yesterday, saying that perhaps all these huge light shows, like you say, it's full on buildings. The entire city just feels lit. From my bedroom, which is near Causeway Bay, my apartment, like, it almost feels like it's still dawn or dusk when it's in the middle of the night because there's such high light pollution. They're asking for all of these buildings to turn off their lights by 11 p.m. So this includes huge luxury brand advertising, all the buildings with their light shows, and the only people they're saying that should be allowed to have lighting through the night are nightclubs, 24-hour stores and mahjong parlours.
So there's going to be plenty of opposition to that, not just from the advertisers on those hoardings, presumably, but from lots of people concerned with the sort of identity of the area. I mean, an enormous sort of 21st century display of incredible light throughout the night sort of is a sign of identity, isn't it, of a city that's moving, that's constantly awake, that's being productive. So presumably there'll be plenty of opposition to that.
Indeed, the opposition is coming from these businesses, but it's also coming from the tourism board, because I think, you know, anyone crossing the harbour to Kowloon side or to Hong Kong side, if you're on the Star Ferry, part of the glamour and the beauty and the romance of doing that at nighttime are these beautiful light shows. So while the people on the conservation side and on energy, who are energy conscious, are realising this is not a good plan, there will be opposition. So in 2 months' time, they're taking a public survey to see what the city really feels about it.
And do you think this comes, you know, from environmental concerns, or is it more, as you say, light pollution in people's homes? Are they the protesters really behind it?
The initial concerns have come from an environmental group, but I think a lot of people, once this public survey goes out, a lot of people will complain. Apparently, in Tsim Sha Tsui, which is on Kowloon side, the night sky is over a thousand times brighter than the normal night sky. And if you're living under that day in, day out, when it feels like you're at daytime at 2 a.m., I'm sure once this survey goes out, many people in Hong Kong will get involved.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Aisha. I believe I'm going to be seeing you actually in Hong Kong next Friday, so we'll see whether it's really dimmed down at all by then. I doubt it. But anyway, Aisha, thank you very much for joining us. That's our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears.
Coming up, what's next for Julian Assange's application for asylum?
The results are out. Monocle's 7th annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
Welcome back to today's Midori House. It's coming up to 16 minutes past the hour. Now, WikiLeaks' Julian Assange walked into London's Ecuadorian embassy 1 year ago today. He was granted political asylum 2 months later, and he's been there ever since.
While it can't be pleasant sleeping in a makeshift bed in a cramped office, living off takeaway food and only enjoying fresh air from the embassy's balcony, Mr. Assange has claimed that he can last for another 5 years. But what does the Ecuadorian embassy think of this, and how is it impacting their reputation? Joining us in the studio to discuss some of the implications for Ecuador is lecturer in law at Birkbeck, University of London, Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Welcome to the show.
It's always a pleasure being here.
Now let's cut to the chase. What do the Ecuadorians think? Do they regret, do you think, a year ago allowing him to take refuge there?
Not at all. I've been in contact with them, actually, and they were very clear from the very beginning that this was going to be a very long issue. It wasn't ever in the mind of the Ecuadorians that this would be resolved quickly. Of course, this is what they desire, as anyone who is for political asylum, for the tradition of political asylum in international law. But all the parties were very realistic about the prospects. So I think they're prepared for the long run here.
Let's talk briefly, if we can, about the sort of physical realities of his day-to-day life, though. We alluded to some of it, sniffing a bit of fresh air from the balcony. I mean, where's he getting his exercise from? Is he really living on takeaway food? Is he sleeping on a camp bed? Are all of these things true?
He has likened his room to living in a space station. I think that's a bit generous. It is a very cramped space. I mean, it was not fitted for being inhabited. But he has friends. You were referring to his exercise. Ken Loke, in fact, gave him a running meal, which he uses in order to keep fit. And, you know, there is a personal trainer who visits him in the embassy. So, as John Pillier put it recently, that's much better than what is on offer in either Sweden or the US.
Now, Ricardo Patino, the foreign minister of Ecuador, has said that he's going to have a changeover of staff here in the Ecuadorian embassy. A new ambassador will be coming. Partly, I think, the feeling that the current ambassador has failed to kind of bring this this thorny problem to a conclusion. But do you really think anybody new is going to have much kind of more impetus? Because it's just a waiting game for the British government. In a way, the story doesn't make the headlines here very much anymore. His hold up there, they probably just think of it as, you know, the Ecuadorians' problem. Of course, there's a price to be paid for the policing. But apart from that, it's no worry for the British government, is it?
Not really. I mean, you mentioned the price. I was surprised, in fact, to learn that it goes up to £12,000 per day. So the bill right now must be close to 4 million, which is something to think about for British people. But I don't think that any change in the diplomatic crew at the embassy will bring about any change. As you mentioned, Andrew, this is an easy game in a sense for the British government. They just have to sit down and wait. There aren't many signs that either of the two parties or the three or four parties involved are ready to come up with any negotiated solution. if any solution comes, it might come from the outcome of the Australian elections. That might make a difference. But otherwise, it's difficult to see the British heeding to the Ecuadorians' claim that, according to international law, they should allow Assange to go.
I wonder what other whistleblowers and the sort of trends in whistleblowing around the world, how that affects his position and the way we look at him. I mean, I note that Assange has given an interview to, I quote, a small group of news agencies on the eve of the of this anniversary. Edward Snowden, of course, is the man we've all been talking about in the last few weeks. So is there a sense in which Assange needs for the spotlight to continue to be on him, that he needs to in order for his plight to be worth anything there at the moment, he needs people to be talking about?
That is very true. And in fact, the trend that seems to be emerging has been advantageous to Assange. Snowden has referred to his case. In fact, Snowden made a very interesting point about the way in which WikiLeaks released all these cables. WikiLeaks has been, and Assange has been, strongly criticized by many, including Carl Bernstein, recently, because all the cables were released without any editing. And Snowden mentioned that this may have been a failure of a procedure. He mentioned that a passphrase was not used. This is a term for the way in which these things are done on the web, and that means that it wasn't just Assange being a bad journalist. But this is also important in terms of the legal case. It is becoming clearer and clearer that the U.S. government is engaged in a war against truth tellers and whistleblowers. And if that is the case, then that strengthens Assange's claim that whether, if he were to put a foot outside of the embassy, he most likely be sent to the U.S. And, if we take into account what is happening with Bradley Manning and others, the consequences would be very, very serious.
Lifting our eyes just from Julian for a moment, Mr. Assange, for the Ecuadorians, is there a bigger game being played here? Are they concerned to kind of present themselves as, the Latin American freedom fighters? Are they interested in tweaking the tail of America? Are they, who's really their bigger audience for this action?
My reading of this at the beginning has to do with an internal political issue. Most listeners would remember that Correa had been criticized for his stance on freedom of expression. He has been in conflict with many media locally in Ecuador. So in a sense, he was calling their bluff. He was saying, okay, if you're for freedom of expression, then you will also have to support our stance on Assange. But now that issue has moved on, and in a sense, it has become a matter of principle. This is how Patiño, the foreign minister, put it. And it is true to say that there is a principled stance among all Latin American governments, not only Ecuador, on the issue of political asylum. It is a sort of Latin American contribution to international law. And this is the reason why Assange told Snowden that he might consider going to Latin America. There is a strong tradition of political asylum there.
Oscar, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But thanks, as ever, for joining us this morning on Midori House. Oscar Guardiola Ribera there. Yes, you're listening to Monocle 24. It's 11:23 in Dubai, 8:23 a.m. here in London. Time now for our preview of this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs.
Dedicated to launching the next wave of social entrepreneurs, the Holt Prize works in partnership with President Clinton and the Clinton Global Initiative to solve some of the world's most pressing social challenges. Its CEO, a former investment banker, founded the prize after studying for an MBA at the Holt International Business School in Boston.
His goal, to attract more business-minded students to the world of social good. The million-dollar prize helps, of course. Pauline Eiferman met Ahmad Ashkar for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs as he stopped by New York for the UN Social Innovation Summit.
The logistics of the Holt Prize is somewhat like the World Cup in a way, where we call to action thousands of college and university students from around the world. So once President Clinton selects and issues the challenge, we then generate a call for apps which goes out to about 700 to 800 universities across 150 countries. From there, we get about 10,000 applicants, and those finalists then move into one of our six regional rounds of pitch-offs around the world. So student teams of about 4 to 5 students develop viable social enterprises that they then pitch in either Boston, San Francisco, London, Dubai, Shanghai, or Sao Paulo. And at that event, we invite local executives from some of the world's top corporations to serve as jury members. Once a winner is selected after that pitch-off takes place, we move each one of those regional winning teams into a 2-month-long program in Boston, Massachusetts. And after that program, each one of those teams then pitches their prototypes and their corporations at the CGI annual meeting. And of course, a winner is selected and awarded by President Clinton, and the prize is $1 million in startup capital to launch some of those companies.
Can you talk a little bit about your partnership with the Clinton Global Initiative?
So our partnership with President Clinton started 3 years ago when I went and visited the Clinton Global Initiative offices in New York City. We thought that the CGI community, which is made up of heads of state, CEOs of the world's top companies, leaders from the nonprofit space, we thought those would be an excellent network for our Holt Prize Council, which supports our startup entrepreneurs. So we approached President Clinton 3 years ago, and today we are the featured opening event that happens at the annual CGI meeting in New York. President Clinton chooses our theme every year, and he does that based around topics that are both close to his heart and, of course, aligned with both the work of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative. What's key to the challenge is that President Clinton tells us where the shortcomings of the existing NGO space are, where the existing corporations that are not contributing to the social benefit of the bottom of the pyramid. So we really get a good idea of framing the challenge from the eyes of President Clinton. So this year, President Clinton chose as our topic food insecurity. There's about 800 million people in the world that suffer from food insecurity. And what we did is, in partnership with President Clinton and his team, we decided to focus and hone in on the urban slum, where about 200 million of those people reside.
So going back a little bit to how the prize started, can you talk about what your background is, what you've done before, and why you decided to create this prize?
My background is in Islamic banking specifically and on the real estate banking side. And as a conventional capitalistic-minded individual prior to coming into business school, I always looked at charity as one thing and profits as another. Very distinct paths. I was sitting at doing my MBA at the Holt International Business School after the fallout of the financial markets, and I was sitting in one of my marketing classes when I heard the CEO and chairman of One Laptop Per Child give a speech in class. And while I wasn't really paying attention, I heard something that he said which really resonated with me. And he said, "We need to sell products to move the needle in education in the developing world." So I raised my hand and I asked the gentleman a question. And I said, "How do you expect poor people to pay for the things they need? We should just give them away for free." And that point brought up a discussion which introduced me to a whole new world of doing good while doing well. The breakthrough and aha moment that I had was, how in the world could a Western educated immigrant not be aware of something called social entrepreneurship? I was well educated, I was well versed, I had a good social community, but I had never thought about the idea of blending business with doing good. So I thought to myself, how many other students around the world also don't know anything about this issue? So I made it a mission to make this first and foremost on the minds of every potential business student around the world.
Why do you think these business students do it? Why do you think people participate in this prize?
Because business students are generally greedy. And again, I'm telling you from firsthand perspective, right? I mean, I created the Holt Prize. I'd never competed in any kind of challenge like this before, but I knew what gets business students motivated. And it's three things. The first one is status. MBA programs and really, I mean, any classroom setting is very competitive. Who can be the best? And our platform gives you a great opportunity to showcase your talents, not just amongst your own peers, but every top university competes in the Holt Prize. from Holt Business School to Harvard Business School to Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, from East Coast to West Coast, from Asia to Australia, okay? So status is one. Number two, it's frankly the opportunity to network with our judging staff. I can guarantee you if you make it into our regional final, you will have an opportunity to solicit any job you want to from those juries. And those juries are often hiring from our pool. So at the end of the day, you go to business school to get a job, competing in the Holt Prize, pretty much if you can make it to the regional final, guarantees you that. So that's two. So the first one, status. The second one is essentially network and securing a job. And then the third one is, I'm not going to underplay the $1 million prize and the CGI network, et cetera, but the $1 million prize is a big enough amount for someone to take a risk. So other challenges out there and other, seed funding or angel and seed rounds that are available to entrepreneurs, you know, are coming out with a $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. How do I tell an iBanker that's got an offer for $185K at the University of Wharton, at Pennsylvania Wharton, to leave $185,000 cush job to enter the space of social entrepreneurship? So when you see $1 million purse divided by four people, right? I mean, it's $250,000 each, right? So the prize is big enough to move the trajectory of that potential iBanker into the space. So I think that's the third reason that people participate in the prize.
That was Ahmad Ashkar, CEO of the Holt Prize, speaking to Monocle's Pauline Eiferman for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, which premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll leaf through the British papers with our news editor, find out how Obama's been received in Berlin, and talk superheroes. Hopefully, it won't make you go...
Andrew, calm yourself.
Dom, I thought that was you after the breakfast.
Yeah, I know. It's a little bit rumbly this morning. I like to have my own string section behind me as well. Barney Burnham's here before all of that. He's got the news headlines.
Dom, I'm very disappointed that you didn't introduce me by saying, is it a bird, is it a plane? However, I will continue. The United Nations says 7.6 million people became refugees last year, and the total number of over 45 million refugees worldwide is now the highest since 1994. UNHCR Chief Antonio Guterres says the figures are alarming and show that there's a new displaced person every 4.1 seconds. Four American soldiers have been killed in an insurgent attack on Bagram Air Base near the Afghan capital Kabul. The attack came just hours after the US announced that it's to begin direct talks with the Taliban. Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff has said she's proud of the tens of thousands of people who've taken part in protests across the country. Demonstrators have taken to the streets demanding improvements to schooling and public transport. They're also angry at the amount of money being spent on new sports stadia and next year's Football World Cup. The newly appointed governor of Luxor, who was a member of a militant group blamed for slaughtering 58 tourists in Egypt's Valley of the Queens in 1997, has promised to keep visitors safe. But Adel Mohamed Al-Kayat's appointment by President Morsi has provoked an angry response. The country's tourism minister has resigned in protest. The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has marked the first anniversary of his taking sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy in London by giving an interview in which he says he won't leave even if Sweden stops pursuing sexual assault claims against him. He says his lawyers have advised him not to leave the embassy as he fears arrest on the order of the United States. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Majority House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Dominic Reynolds.
You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier.
Now, brace yourselves. You heard a villain there, and the superhero army is warming up. It's about to get your multiplex in quite the headlock. Superman, Wolverine, and Thor will land in cinemas around the world with an enormous thump in the next few weeks. And after them, there are more on the way. Sequels to Spider-Man, Captain America, and X-Men are all in the works, circling above screens in a sort of muscly holding pattern. Why are there so many of them? Well, because they still make excellent business sense, of course. Billions of dollars of it.
joining us now in studio to help us understand why superheroes are soaring to the top of the box office is film critic and Monocle regular Tim Robey. Tim, thank you for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
So let's ask that big question first of all. Why are there so many of them coming out at the same time, and why are we so in love with these films still?
I think there are two answers. The root appeal of superheroes is always remains the same, which is basically wish fulfillment for the kind of core audience of comic fans, you know, growing up, feeling a bit peeved, maybe wanting to kind of get their own back at school. It's a great kind of fantasy to be able to kind of have these idols, these guys who kind of, you know, have superpowers, can kind of get the girl, etc. So there's that element of it. And then recently, I think since about Spider-Man 2002, there's been a real flourishing in the genre. And I think that's down to two things, which is, firstly, special effects are now good enough that everything that happens in the comics can be easily achieved on screen, which wasn't necessarily the case before. But also, those films have kind of coincided, given that superheroes are totally an American genre, they've coincided with a period in America where I think Americans have felt kind of under external threat more than ever before, possibly more than since the 50s, when, again, we saw lots of superheroes. As a result, you know, the idea of superheroes being able to bat off these villains, kind of repel these threats, is quite appealing, I think, to the public.
And obviously the business angle is hugely enticing. You know, studios, of course, have bottom lines, and they've seen them increase a lot with these types of films. I mean, they're bankable, aren't they? They don't make the medium-sized films anymore. Studios make the little indie films, and they make these enormous tentpole films that they can, you know, predict next year and the next year's numbers off the back of.
Exactly. They're kind of reliable banker, really, and they'll start remaking them within, you know, within 10 years or even 5 years.
Well, this is what I didn't understand about Spider-Man. We just had one, and then there's a new Spider-Man.
Exactly, which pretty much follows the exact same plot. And you could say that, you know, Man of Steel follows the same plot that Superman Returns did 5 years ago, and they're constantly renewing them. And whenever they are perceived to have been less successful, like the Hulk films, in fact, they repeat them again. They just have another go until they kind of get it right, and then they'll do spin-offs and sequels. So the Avengers will produce a sequel very soon, and there's Thor 2, and there's everything else. You
know? And audiences don't complain. I mean, they're voting with their feet, and no one's called the studio's bluff and said, hang on, you've given us that 4 years ago, we're just not going to go and see it. They're seeing them. So
the problem is they see them and then complain, but the money has already been made.
Can I ask you, why is it such a kind of a strict kind of list of things that has to be ticked off for a superhero? They're always American, as you say. You can't really imagine, you know, a French superhero. Perhaps his cape would be made by Jean-Paul Gaultier or something. But why is it they're always American, nearly always guys? As I think you've pointed out before, you know, they've tried to make female successful superhero films, but it never quite takes off in the same way.
Yeah, that's sort of a self-fulfilling problem in a way, because they always say, oh, well, the ones with women as the heroines never work. Then they make really shoddy films which don't work, and that's sort of proves the point. They just haven't tried hard enough, I think. If you look at films like Catwoman was particularly bad. Also, Elektra with Jennifer Garner, and there was one with Charlize Theron called Aeon Flux, which were huge flops and have led to this perception that you can only really do it with guys. But I think they just need to work harder, because you can actually produce a blockbuster with a woman in the sort of middle of it, like The Hunger Games or something, and it will work. It's a funny formula that they do seem to stick to, and what works then works again, and it becomes kind of repetitive, but they just keep going with it.
I mean, they are to outside eyes like ours, we're not 15-year-old boys, that they are pretty formulaic, and they look the same. It's a different suit, the poster looks different, but it's the same story. But I suppose there is the argument that within these broadly superhero films, there are different genre pictures taking place, that the Christopher Nolan Batman films are very different from the wisecracking Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man films.
That's definitely true, yeah. And those come from different stables. You know, there's the Marvel comics, which is Spider-Man, etc., and the Avengers, which are a little bit lighter-hearted. And then there's the DC comics, kind of gritty, serious. And Christopher Nolan, certainly with his Batman films, has tried to engage with the themes of kind of America under threat and with terrorism. I mean, for instance, the villains in the Batman movies are kind of aligned with terrorism. Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight, they say, you know, he just wants to see the world burn. And it becomes about Batman as this kind of avenging force who's taking control of the retaliation and kind of doing the best thing for Gotham City, even though it may not realize that this is what's best for it. So actually, Nolan is sort of trying to think through, you know, sort of foreign policy in these films in a kind of a fairly kind of broad way.
Another weird stitch they always try to put on this kind of tapestry of the superhero is the idea of sex and romance, which is so complicated for superheroes, not just because they can't get their kind of tights off quick enough, but you know, that you don't know whether they can have sex, whether they kind of who they fancy, are they going to chase you around with a whip, or are they kind of actually, what's going on there? Why do they still need this element of romance, and why is it so complicated in those films?
Yeah, you imagine it might be particularly complicated with the Hulk, someone you don't really want to make angry in bed, but but in fact, what's happened lately is I think that element has slightly receded. So in Man of Steel, you know, we think of Lois Lane as a really important figure for Superman. But in Man of Steel, in fact, Amy Adams, who plays her as a kind of serious investigative reporter, is slightly left to the margins, because I think they've decided, no, we're going to go down the Nolan route of making it really serious and masculine and kind of gritty and important. And we don't need her so much. We actually want his dads, he has two dads, to come back and keep giving him advice from kind of beyond the grave instead. So we've lost that chemistry, in fact, that Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder had in the 1970s version of Superman.
I mean, what about the argument that sort of sits behind all of this, which is that thing about the a certain type of movie not being made anymore? And we heard, I think it was Steven Spielberg, say at some point in the last few days that the future model of movie making is going to be you pay more if it costs more to make. So your Iron Man 7 or whatever it might be will cost you £15, but it might cost a fiver to go and see the latest quirky indie movie. Is that what this is all leading towards?
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I think the indie movies might profit from that a bit, actually, as kind of counter-programming. But yeah, it's just a bit of a shame that originality gets left out, you know. I think when Christopher Nolan makes a film like Inception, which incorporates all of the kind of effects and razzle-dazzle, but actually tries to tell an original story, that's more of a positive sign that Hollywood can kind of move forward and get beyond these patterned plots that are always the same.
So you've obviously seen Man of Steel. Is it good?
Yeah, it is pretty good. I do think it takes itself a little bit too seriously, and all the fans are sort of saying, well, no, that's what Superman's meant to be like. But I think a little bit of contrast and levity would actually have helped it and would have humanised the character a bit
Tim,
more.
Sorry to interrupt you. We've got a clip. Let's hear from the Man of Steel.
You will give the people of Earth an ideal to strive towards. They will race behind you. They will stumble. They will fall. But in time, they will join you in the sun. In time, you will help them accomplish wonders.
Oh, it's got my blood up. Wow, I mean, that sounds terrifically exciting. Is it worth us going to see?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it's particularly if you're into the Batman films and the kind of heavy, sort of thunderous bombast of those films, it does work.
You can hear the Hans Zimmer score pounding
totally,
away in the
background. Yeah, it's a really good score, actually. No, it's huge. It's definitely got to be seen, and everyone's seeing it.
Okay. Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid.
We've taken Monocle's Shop in Shop around the world, and next week we'll be touching down in the throbbing heart of Asia, Bangkok, to open a seasonal shop for 1 week only from the 26th of June. Following similar initiatives in cities around the world from Paris to Jakarta, Monocle are partnering with the interior design retail space Sansiri Lounge in Bangkok to offer a range of Monocle products, including accessories, homewares, stationery and fashion, and collaborations with some of our favourite designers. So, whether you're treating a loved one or just spoiling yourself, come to the Monocle Shop and Shop in Bangkok. You can find us on the third floor of the Siam Paragon Shopping Centre from the 26th of June to the 1st of July.
You're listening to Midori House, and it's currently 8:43 here in London, which means it's 9:43 in Berlin, which is where we head now to speak with our woman there, Kimberly Bradley. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Now, you've got a star visitor today in Berlin.
Oh, yes. US President Obama arrived last night on Air Force One at about 8:30, and he started his itinerary today, just about now.
And what's he doing there?
Right now he's meeting with Joachim Gauck, who's our president. He will then, after that, meet with Angela Merkel, take a couple little tours around the city, and give a huge speech at 3 p.m. in front of the Brandenburg Gate, which is happening 50 years almost to the day after JFK's Ich bin ein Berliner speech. The talks are about a whole bunch of different things, mainly free trade over the Atlantic. But I know that Merkel's going to be asking him a few questions about the PRISM issues that have come up recently in the U.S.
Yeah, and clearly there's going to be some opposition, quite vocal opposition out there on the streets. I suppose every time Obama comes to Berlin, inevitably we think of that speech on his original campaign in 08 and the incredibly warm welcome he got there. Is it likely that there's going to be the sort of lack of warmth is going to be pretty notable this time round, given what's going on with the NSA?
That's true, but it's also a different kind of event because back then he was a candidate. He spoke at the Victory Pillar, which is on a very long major street through the city, so 200,000 people showed up and could just stand on the streets. This time, there's a lot of security. There are 8,000 policemen, and the speech is meant for only 4,000 invited guests, so they'll be standing kind of in a cordoned-off space in front of the Brandenburg Gate. What is very different is that there are a lot of demonstrators already on the streets, talking about Guantanamo, asking about PRISM. They're kind of already out there right now. I think 8 different demonstrations are registered with the city.
And Kimberly, one of the interesting points that came up is, you know, that this the NSA story with PRISM is that, you know, it touches on a very sensitive issue for Germans, which is, you know, the collecting of information about you without your knowledge, which refers back obviously to what happened to many East Germans under the Stasi. It's a very sensitive issue for Berliners. Do you think, again, that's one of the kind of reasons that he will be kind of not supported as he was in the past?
Absolutely. That's one of the most sensitive things, because not only the communist regime did this, but the Third Reich. And there's a word in German called Datenschutz, which has created all kinds of different difficulties, even with the internet. I mean, Datenschutz means data protection here, and it's one of those very, very sacred cows in this country. And just the idea that not only, you know, these larger countries are watching what Germans do and they can't really do anything about it, it's creating tremendous vocal popular opposition. And we'll have to see how Merkel touches on this. She's got a kind of difficult position too, because she's got an election coming up. She doesn't want to stir up too much. I mean, that's also clear.
Kimberly, let's talk about another sort of expression of dissent on the streets, and that's the significant Turkish population in Kreuzberg has been joining with Turks back in the homeland, protesting against Erdogan. What exactly has been going on?
There have been demonstrations. First of all, I'll just say that Kreuzberg has one of the largest Turkish communities outside of Turkey, and it's been that way for at least 40 years. A lot of Turkish immigrants came to Germany to help rebuild the country, and they've set up quite a strong insular community. There have been repeated demonstrations to show solidarity to the Turks in Turkey. What's been a bit interesting is that the demographics are very similar to those in Turkey. I mean, the people demonstrating in Kreuzberg are young. They tend to be Turkish-German or integrated, whereas you're not seeing a lot of older people running out, and it kind of reflects, you know, basically what we're seeing over there. But it's repeated. Like, each time something happens in Turkey, there's usually the next day something quite large that happens in Kreuzberg.
And can I ask you, Kimberly, it's interesting. We had a very good report last night here in London, which was about the fact that the demonstrations going on in Brazil, you're seeing the expat community here. Often people are doing quite well, actually, living in London, but they felt some empathy with what was happening back in their home cities in Rio and Sao Paulo, that they felt that the need to get on the streets. The Turkish community that lives in Germany, is it normally very politically active? It, you know, does it have its own kind of political parties? You know, is it kind of good at electing its own candidates for city positions?
Actually, not really. It's been criticized. The Turkish community here has been criticized for being insular. What's interesting, though, is the generation that came after the original generation is quite integrated. It's not. I would not say that. Beyond a few isolated examples, I wouldn't say that it's a force in itself. There are a few people in city government here who are Turkish, and they represent basically all minority communities, but I wouldn't say, no, not quite. What is interesting, though, is that the younger people are very concerned with what's going on back home, even if they've never lived there.
Kimberly, let's talk, if we can, about German architecture and big plans, but not a lot happening in a couple of instances. Tell us what's been going on.
The most recent architectural forward move would be the laying of the cornerstone of the Berlin City Castle, which Spiegel magazine, for example, is wondering if will be possibly the fourth problematic architectural project going on here. It already is. In 2008, the Palast der Republik, which was the parliament building for East Germany, was raised. And there's been a big field in the middle of the city on the eastern side of Berlin, which will ultimately be the site of a rebuilt Prussian palace, which will house some of the antiquities that are in the Berlin museums and be a cultural forum. The problem is there's not enough money to build it, and this seems to be, it has to do with the airport or Stuttgart 21 or also the Philharmonic in Hamburg. The laying of the cornerstone was very symbolic, but a lot of us here in Berlin are wondering if this castle will ever be built. It has a price tag right now of 590 million, and the federal government has pledged 478, so there's a bit of a shortfall.
And Kimberly, tell me, you live in Berlin, and Berlin's had this kind of amazing reputation as a thriving city, young and at heart, and now it's kind of attached itself to these kind of big, colossal architectural projects that have gone horribly wrong. Germany as a country is known for massive efficiency, can build anything. Again, not good for brand Germany. Are people getting a bit embarrassed about the kind of the way that these projects, it's almost like Britain.
People
in fact, we've shrugged off our reputation a little bit, but that was our reputation like 10 years ago, and it dents you.
No, it's true. People are, of course, horrifically embarrassed about it. I mean, the Berliners are good at making jokes about the airport. There's a huge joke going right now that Obama should say, Mr. Wovereit, open this airport, because he's going to be standing where Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It's a horrific embarrassment. At the same time, I think right now what we need to focus on is moving forward, getting these things finished. What's the next step? And luckily with the airport, we have a new CEO since March, and he has proposed very recently opening the airport in stages. For example, next summer opening just the southern runway. And he just made a proposal to EasyJet to occupy the north wing, which is where the charter flights would just be. And that could happen as early as late this year, which makes some sense. It makes it less of an embarrassment. We're not promising a grand opening date that can't be kept. So I think that's one solution. It's embarrassing, but we need to figure out a way out.
Kimberly, thank you for updating us on those. You keep an eye on the progress of construction, I'm sure. Kimberly Bradley's our woman in Berlin. Thanks for joining us on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Dominic Reynolds. And joining us now to review the British papers is Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Andrew, and morning, Dom. How are you both today?
Very good, thank you.
I'm positively chipper.
Where are you going to start today?
Well, most of the paper, there's one thing the Brits love to talk about, is the weather. And I know it's almost tedious to pick this up in newspaper review, but every newspaper is obsessing by the fact that we're apparently entering some kind of unprecedented period of mega awful summers.
I think we've well and truly entered it like 2 years ago. What's happening?
Well, no, this is why. So apparently, according to reports from scientists, Andrew, and they know how these things work, we're in a cycle that's going to last between 10 and 20 years.
We've seen them before.
There was one in the 1950s. Dom, I'm sure you remember that one.
Yeah, big time's terrible.
1960s and the 1880s.
Well, the 1880s one I don't remember, I'm afraid. So what they're saying is it's going to be rubbish, and it's going to be rubbish for 20 years, but it is cyclical. So eventually, when we're old and grey, we'll have a hot summer
exactly.
again.
Exactly. They said, take reassurance from the fact that it will end.
I put an application in to open the Capri Bureau this morning.
It's time. It's definitely time to escape. But shall I just tell you something that might ameliorate it? If you're a fan of,
please,
for example, interesting
good
wildlife, because of partly linked to this terrible weather conditions, there's going to be a plague of daddy long legs.
Oh no! I mean, that's a fine plague, isn't it? No one minds about the humble
daddy. That's what I'm saying. Maybe that's an upbeat. Maybe that's a positive side of this story.
Now, actually, our building upstairs, when you open the windows, it goes onto a park. And when we first moved in here, we had the lights on at night. The windows open. It was very warm. And many of them came in. A member of staff, male, who I won't name, screamed quite a lot as they came through the windows.
I don't like them.
I don't
drag the legs behind them. They get in your face.
Yeah, they seem to lack self control.
Well, then
I fear what
they're
they may
silent,
do next.
You see, it's not like a wasp. You can kind of hear.
But
it.
They can't bite you or anything. Well, they can only tickle you.
Well, that I don't trust anyone who claims to be called daddy.
The silent menace. One other quick thing that's reported in the Times of London, of course. One other story I just thought I'd mention in here. You never know; it might come in useful one day. Is the headline? Do you have cupboards in your home so full of junk you dare not open them? Apparently we're getting worse at hoarding.
Yes.
And the things we keep is things like old paperwork. 50% of people have stuff they don't need. Old mobile phone chargers. 1 in 2 people has their old mobile phone charger. Why? Yeah, why do we have that?
Guilty as charged. Because it might be useful later.
<It's> excellent.
Do they have a picture of Rob Bound's desk in there?
No, he falls under some special separate category, I believe.
But you can see why we have these things, we gather them, they're something that's hugely desirable for a very short period of time, and then it is replaced by the next thing. So
I feel a little bit like that sometimes, don't
I? Yeah, I know. 4 minutes time, the chair will be vacated. But, you know, we have them lying around in drawers because we can't switch our minds from thinking how valuable they used to be.
It would be very, I think it would be very freeing, very liberating. To cast off some of these items.
Are you pitching for your own TV show?
Oh, I'm just saying.
Tom's Makeover.
There's a lot of people who could benefit from that.
Okay, The Telegraph.
Yeah, The Telegraph. This actually kind of picks up in a strange way with one of the aspects of your superhero chat you were having earlier. Mm-hmm. I know we were talking slightly flippantly about, you know, superheroes.
We weren't talking flippantly. No, we were talking intelligently.
No,
intelligently.
No, but I mean about one aspect of it in particular, which was how do they cast off their lycra and oversized underpants?
Yes.
Maybe in a bedroom scenario.
Okay.
And it's quite interesting. The
you've got tips for this as well, have you?
Well, no. It's interesting. There's been a call from some leading writers to improve sex scenes in books for teenagers, saying people are far too Victorian in their attitudes about it, and it would actually be very helpful in terms of how young people develop and their ideas about sex. And it's interesting because on the same page of Telegraph, there's a big piece warning about protecting children from pornography on the internet. And I think that perhaps there is a risk for younger teenagers, I don't know, who maybe have slightly misguided views about sex,
mm-hmm.
And they're misled by what they see on the internet, and they're not given good advice from people who actually write well about sex and about relationships. So, and I think that's an interesting call from Mallory Blackman, who's a writer of teenage fiction.
And it is fascinating that, you know, you pick up a kid's book and you know, if there's any sex at all, it's going to be very kind of demure. But these same kids are probably logging onto the internet when their parents aren't looking. I've seen more things than any other kind of adult of this generation would have seen when they were growing up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I'm not sure how helpful that is. And I think that what we should do is entrust, you know, good writers who understand and write well about everything, of which obviously, you know, sex is an important part, to help to paint a fuller picture of the scene.
Interesting. I mean, I suppose the only thing to do after that is to stop children just watching things on the internet and not reading books.
Well, that's,
of course,
that's a mildly intolerant attitude. I just might end with one picture that's also in the Telegraph. Spiked. Not everyone had a ball in Cambridge. This is a slightly macabre and grotesque picture. It's people, Mayball revelers returning at dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, I don't know if you can see this picture of this chap's face. He doesn't look very pleased. He's on a wheelchair. He's stepped kind of vertically onto a wine glass. I don't know, Dom, can you see that?
Oh, that looks nasty.
Yeah. I just thought I'd mention that. If you have a copy of the Telegraph to hand, do check it out. Yeah. If you have a taste for the macabre.
He needed to get his shoes resold. That's the problem. If you don't get to the cobbler in time, that'll happen to you too. Terrible.
Poor guy.
Tom, that's all we've got time for today's show. But thank you very much, our news editor, Tom Edwards. It is the end of the show. Our producers for today were Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney. Our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tess McCann too. Toby Hammond was the man in charge of the studio. The menu's up next. That's with Marcus Hippie, of course. And Tom Burgess Watson will join Tom Edwards for Midori House at exactly the same time tomorrow. But from me and from Andrew, thanks for listening. Goodbye. We'll be right back.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.